Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Today's episode is about sexual assault, so I would like to emphasize listener discretion. Mark Twain once said, "Nothing spoils a good story like the arrival of an eyewitness." Of course, he died in 1910. When eyewitness testimony mattered most. Blood typing wouldn't be used in courts until the late 1930s, and of course DNA wasn't widely used until the late 1990s. Even after blood typing began, eyewitness testimony was considered the most important evidence, second only to a signed confession. Unfortunately, that's a myth, and one that endures even into the modern age, though we are getting better. In late July of 1984, a college student in Burlington, North Carolina, was raped at knife point in her apartment. Jennifer Thompson refused to give in to her fear and rage. She remained calm and memorized every detail of his face. She was determined to not only survive this attack, but to make sure that this man would not escape justice. She would be called the perfect witness. Smart, calm, and collected. She identified her attacker in a photo array and a personal lineup. Then she twice identified him in court. She was wrong. DNA evidence finally exonerated him in 1995, and Jennifer Thompson fell into guilt and despair over her mistake. But she put her own shame into action and became an activist for the fallibility of eyewitness testimony, criminal justice reform, and the power of forgiveness. And she formed an incredible friendship with a man she had wrongly accused. Welcome to episode 84, The Rape of Jennifer Thompson, Wrongful Conviction of Ronald Cotton, and Their Enduring Legacy. Jennifer Thompson was 22 years old, with a 4.0 grade point average at Elon College in Burlington, North Carolina. Her boyfriend, Paul, was from Burlington and in his first year of business school at UNC Chapel Hill, but he was home from school that summer. She decided to stay in Burlington that summer as well to be with Paul and take a few summer classes. Blonde, 5'2" tall, Jennifer taught aerobics on the weekend, lifted weights, and played a lot of tennis with her boyfriend at the Alamance County Country Club. She preferred to walk the 3 miles to and from campus every day for even more exercise. She was a self-professed neat freak. She loved a clean home and made her bed every morning. And she thought she was safe. This was 1984. We understood stranger danger. We understood the particular dangers young women faced. Jennifer knew better than to walk down a dark alley. She didn't jog at night. She locked her doors and windows. It was a hot and sticky Saturday in late July. After she taught her aerobics class, she spent the afternoon with Paul, shopping and getting lunch. After napping in the air conditioning, they played tennis and then went to their favorite Chinese restaurant. Jennifer didn't have anything alcoholic to drink, just iced tea. But she had a headache when they got home from the restaurant anyway, probably from the MSG in the food, she thought. She turned her air conditioning up full blast and went to bed. Paul came in shortly with aspirin and a glass of water. She wrote that she fell asleep to him rubbing her back. Paul reported that around 11 p.m., once Jennifer was asleep, he decided to slip out of bed and head over to his parents' house for the night so he wouldn't disturb her. He locked the door behind him as he left. Around 3 a.m., Jennifer felt something brush her arm. A few moments before, she thought she had heard feet shuffling, but drowsed back to sleep, thinking she was dreaming. But as soon as she felt something on her arm, her heart started pounding, and she tried to focus her eyes in the dark. She pulled the sheets up to her neck and peered around her room, terrified. She finally saw the shape of someone crouching by her bed. She cried, "Who is that? Who's there?" The man sprang up and jumped on top of her within seconds. She immediately started screaming, and then felt something cold and metallic pressed into her neck. She froze. "Shut up or I'll cut you," Jennifer said the man hissed at her. He put a gloved hand over her mouth. She tried to say she couldn't breathe, and he seemed to understand, moving his hand away from her mouth and using it to pin her arms over her head. "Scream and I'll kill you," he promised her. Jennifer didn't immediately think of rape. She thought he was there to rob her. "My wallet is in the den," she told him. "Take all my money." "I got your $10, he said, mocking her, "but I don't want your fucking money." And then he yanked off her underwear. With horror, she realized she would be raped and possibly killed. All she could think was, "I don't want to die. I want to live." Her rapist said, "Just relax. It's been a long time for you, hasn't it, baby?" And then he forced oral sex on her. Jennifer later wrote that her body went rigid and she was nauseated. She said her mind wanted to drift, but she knew she had to stay focused. He said, "Your man's overseas in Germany, ain't he?" Jennifer said she was stunned. It wasn't her boyfriend, but her brother that was overseas. But how did her rapist know this? He said, quote, "I know all about you, Jennifer. You from Winston-Salem." Then she heard him unzip his pants and kick off his shoes. She smelled cigarette smoke on him. And then he was inside of her. He told her he knew she wore glasses. He thought she couldn't see him. What he didn't know was that her glasses were for distance. She could read without them, and she could see the man in front of her just fine. She memorized his features. He was a black man with close-cropped hair. He had almond-shaped, small, and deep-set eyes. He had high, broad cheekbones and just a faint mustache. Trying to keep her wits about her, even as she was being raped, she told him, "I'm afraid of knives. I can't relax until you put it down. Can you put it outside?" "You ain't gonna call the police?" he asked. "No," she promised. "Just drop it outside on my car, please. I can't relax." She was purposely using his word, relax. He got up and put his shoes on. She said he went slowly, as if he was testing her. She suddenly stood up and said, "I have to pee," and then headed down the hallway towards the bathroom. She had grabbed a blanket off of her bed and wrapped it around herself. She stepped into the bathroom and flipped on the light, and he screamed, "Turn it off!" She closed the door and ran some water while checking the small window in the bathroom. It was too small to climb out, and she didn't want to get trapped in the bathroom. So she walked back out. He was standing in the living room near her front door. "You gonna let me back in, right?" he asked. She said she did her best to reassure him, and then watched as he opened the door and dropped the knife on her porch. Then he slammed and locked the door behind him. He never went outside. He told her to turn on the stereo. She did, and a song from Kiss blasted through the speakers. She realized she would never get around him to the front door. She had better try for the back door. She said casually, "I'm thirsty. I'm going to get a drink. You want something?" He was playing with her stereo, looking for another station, and said, "Yeah. Fix me something with Seagram's and let's make it a party." Then he said, "Can I have this?" It was a photo of Jennifer in a swimsuit. She was surprised that he asked, but nodded and he put it in his back pocket. As she walked to the kitchen, she went over his clothing in her head, memorizing everything. She had stood near him and guessed his height around 6 feet tall. He wore dark khakis, a blue shirt with stripes on the sleeve, and canvas boat shoes. The gloves he wore were white knit. She flipped on the light switch again in the kitchen, knowing he wouldn't want to get that close to her in the light. She made sure to make plenty of noise, running water, clinking ice into glasses, banging the cabinet doors. But he suddenly yelled, "Is that door locked?" And now Jennifer ran. straight out her back door into her backyard. She said it was misting rain and the grass was slick and cool. She tried her closest neighbor's door first, banging and screaming, but there was no answer and she knew she didn't have time to wait. He was right on her heels, so she kept running. She ran across the yard to the next building in her apartment complex and was terrified because she knew the damp grass was masking his footsteps, and in the dark, she couldn't see him. Finally, she saw a light on at a house. There was a low fence separating this house and her apartment buildings, and she hopped over it. Frantically, she screamed, "Help me, please!" She was ringing the doorbell and banging on the screen door. "I've been raped by a black man. He's after me." The couple inside was awake, and the woman recognized Jennifer as a student at Elon and said, "Let her in." They called 911, with the man standing by the door with a baseball bat, because Jennifer's rapist was pacing all around the house. But he was gone once they heard the sirens. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Burlington, North Carolina is often described as a sleepy small southern town. It's also a college town, so it tends to boom in the school year and slow down in the hot, humid summers. It had a population of under 40,000 when Jennifer was attacked there. It's not much bigger now, still under 60,000. As with many small towns, Burlington grew up around the railroad. The North Carolina Railroad needed land in the 1850s where they could build, repair, and maintain its tracks. Located in the northern middle part of North Carolina, nowhere near a beach, it's characterized as being a mainly flat land with a few rolling hills. As a part of Alamance County, though, the town offers hiking and boating opportunities on the Hall River Trail and the North Carolina Mountains to Sea Trail. So basically, it's your idyllic small town, a place where people like to raise their kids, a safe place to send your daughter off to college. Jennifer Eileen Thompson was born in Winston-Salem, about an hour from Burlington, on May 28, 1962. By 1984, she was an extremely accomplished and high-achieving young lady, with a 4.0 grade point average, as I said. She was the second of four children and led a fairly sheltered life in Winston-Salem before college. She was homecoming queen of her high school. Ever athletic, she was majoring in sports management at Elon when she was attacked. In the early morning hours of July 29th, she fled out her back door after fooling her rapist with her calm demeanor. It's not often a violent rapist can be talked down like that. But her attacker agreed to put away his knife, let her use the restroom, and believed her when she offered him a drink. She was smart in every way, even mirroring his language. You would think she was a psych major. And she did not let herself fall apart, even in the ambulance, on the way to Memorial Hospital. She later said she has blank spots in her memory after being put in the ambulance, which is understandable. But her memory of the attack has always been clear. When she got to the hospital, she was told to undress, and only then she realized that the man and woman who let her into their home that night had given her clothes from their teenage daughter to wear, instead of letting her stay wrapped in that blanket. She recalled that the doctor brought in to examine her seemed surly, pissed even, that he was called in at that hour. This was long before hospitals had sexual assault nurses or dedicated teams to intake a rape victim. She said the doctor was sloppy and unsympathetic. She would later find out just how right she was. The detective assigned to her case, Mike Galden, asked if she had gotten the morning after pill or a penicillin shot. When she said no, he apologized and explained he had to take her back to the hospital for more testing. This time, she was taken to the Alamance County Hospital, where a better rape kit was performed, and she was given the proper medication. And this was after she had spent hours at the police station, answering questions, and helping build a composite sketch of her rapist. At the first hospital, they asked who they could call for her. She asked for her boyfriend and her sister Janet. Janet lived further away, so Paul got there first and drove her to the police station. Also at the first hospital, she heard another woman sobbing behind the curtain. When she asked what happened, the detective paused for a moment and then said she was raped. We think it was the same guy. She had emphatically told the detective that she could identify her attacker if she saw him again. When she got to the station, her sister engulfed her in a hug, and they called her parents. They seemed to ask many questions, and she heard Janet say, "Yes, she's physically okay." When Jennifer got on the phone with her mother, she said her mother said, quote, "Do you think it was someone who saw you in your leotard at work?" Jennifer shut down at this. She talks plainly in the book, Picking Cotton, that her parents had difficulty facing her rape and discussing it. And she was often given the impression, not just by her parents, that, well, she was just raped. She wasn't really hurt. This sort of attitude was common in the 1980s. But Jennifer was hurt by these comments. And in the upcoming months and years, she would wish that she did have some physical scar for people to see, not the internal scarring that never heals from sexual assault. Detective Galdon asked her if she wanted Paul in the room when she was interviewed. I'm sure the detective knew this situation, that a boyfriend could be a comfort, but that it could also cause the victim to hold back. But Jennifer wanted Paul in the room. She did not want to have to retell what happened that night to him privately. Let him hear her statement. But then she found she could not look at him during the interview as he sat in the corner, shell-shocked. She was composed as she gave her statement and confidently said yes to working with a composite sketch artist. She sat for hours looking at different facial features in their book, choosing the closest she could to her rapist's eyes, nose, mouth, hair, and anything else she could remember. In the end, she was happy with the composite sketch. Although it wasn't perfect, it was a pretty good match to her memory. Following her second trip to the hospital for a more thorough rape exam, Paul drove her home. The police had already processed the crime scene. As she walked around her apartment, she knew she would never return. She needed to answer questions about anything she noticed that was disturbed or out of place. She mentioned to the investigators that she had had trouble with her back door that summer. It had been hard to close and not fitting right in the frame. This is common in humid areas. "I have a back door that often gets stuck in the summers and a gate that refuses to close." For someone growing up in the South, she wasn't that concerned. She could still lock the door. But the officers told her it had probably made it easier for her attacker to pry open the door. There had been 3 small knife jabs to the frame of the door. It hadn't taken much to get the door open because of the humidity. Officers found a small piece of dark foam rubber. They thought it looked like something that would come from a sneaker or tennis shoe. She adamantly said, "No, that was not here before. I would have seen it." She was an impeccable housekeeper. She was able to point out where her rapist had rifled through letters and postcards and photographs, as well as her purse. She wondered how long he was in the apartment before he woke her up. When the detective asked if she was ready to go, she thought, where? Where was she going? Paul took her home to his parents' house. She was finally able to shower and wanted to go to sleep. Paul's mother refused to let her and Paul sleep in the same bed, no matter how much Jennifer needed his comfort. But she had invited Jennifer's sister Janet and her boyfriend to spend the night as well. So she set the 3 of them up in a guest room with 3 single beds. Janet took the bed next to hers. But the minute Jennifer started drifting off, she would bolt up in bed sobbing hysterically. Her sister got in the bed with her and held her through that first long night. By the next morning, her rape was on the news on every channel. They showed the composite sketch that she helped with, and it was also in the paper. The report said that there were three burglaries that night, and two of the burglary victims were assaulted. She was now an anonymous victim. Someone who is now a white woman that had been raped by a black man. Worse, he raped another white woman after her. It's not like racial stereotypes don't exist today and that we don't have racial profiling, but this was the 1980s. Jennifer writes about the, quote, audacity of a black man raping a white woman. The community was more focused on that than the actual trauma she had suffered. Paul drove her to a place called Grandfather Mountain, where her mother was staying. It was 3 hours from Burlington, billing itself as a sanctuary for the human spirit. Her mother, like Paul's, forbid them from sharing a bed. Her mother had bought flowers with a Get Well Soon card attached, as if she had the flu, Jennifer remembered. I want to be clear that I'm not criticizing her mother or Paul's. It was a different time. No one talked about rape or rape trauma. No one knew what to say to her. From reading her book, I think her sister Janet was the only one in her life at the time who seemed to be able to face what had happened. Jennifer wrote that her baby sister became her protector. But Janet had to return to school. She would always be at her sister's side for court appearances and anytime she needed her, but Jennifer had to insist that Janet go back to school. So she spent that next night alone in bed, and she woke screaming again. She thought someone was outside her bedroom window. Paul checked. There was nothing. But it would be years before Jennifer really slept easy again. The next morning, she got a call from Detective Galden. He wanted her to come in and look at a photo array. He insisted, quote, the suspect may or may not be included in the array, but obviously to Jennifer, he was. Why else would she be called in to look? This was the beginning of what would come to be known as unconscious transference. Her actual rapist was not in that photo array. But because the detective thought he was, she picked the photo she thought looked closest to her rapist. She would later say that this first photo array influenced her in-person identification. The man she chose from the photos became the rapist in her memories. Jennifer had been so careful. She had purposely remembered every detail. She kept her eyes open when so many would have shut them in the agony of sexual assault. But she kept hers wide open to identify the man who had violated her. She later berated herself, saying that this identification had only taken 5 minutes. It wasn't her fault, but it took Jennifer many years to come to terms with that. The man she chose from the photo array was named Ronald Jr. Cotton. He was her age. He was from the area and had grown up in the projects. He had a record. He had already served 18 months for breaking and entering and the attempted sexual assault of a 14-year-old girl. He would later insist that he and the girl had been in a relationship, but because she was white and he was black, they charged him when her father called the cops. His court-appointed attorney told him to take the deal. This was not uncommon. Not for court-appointed attorneys and not for black men. They knew the odds. Ronald Cotton would come to regret not fighting that charge. He was 16 years old when it happened. He served his time and was back living at his mother's house when Jennifer was raped. He worked at Somers Seafood, which did happen to be near Jennifer's apartment complex. One of the managers had called the cops when he saw the composite sketch on the news. Another detective, not as delicate as Galden, a man called Sully, said, quote, she was white too, only 14. Yeah, that does not sound great until you remember Ronald was only 16. Ron would later insist that Alamance County and Burlington officials targeted him because he was known to date white women. He was, in fact, dating a white woman at the time of Jennifer's rape. despite the fact that hospitals didn't have sexual assault nurses or teams of professionals to handle these types of crimes. Jennifer was assigned a counselor to guide her through the legal process, as well as her personal trauma. Jennifer loved her. Her name was Sadie, and she was with Jennifer through every step. Now, in the face of friends, family, and her own boyfriend who just couldn't understand, Sadie was her rock. Sadie understood. She had come to the hospital that first night to see Jennifer. And when Jennifer was called back to the police station on August 8th, Sadie was the one who accompanied her. It was only 11 days after her rape. But based on her photo identification, the police were ready to move forward with a physical in-person ID. Only, it wasn't what you see in the movies or on TV. Unfortunately, the Burlington Police Department was housed in a temporary building as a new one was being built. Jennifer was not protected by a two-way mirror like we always see on TV. She was not even protected by plexiglass. She walked into a basement room and gasped when she saw seven black men standing against the wall with only a conference room table between them and her. Detective Galdon tried to reassure her. "I'm right here. Nothing can hurt you," he said. Each man had to step forward and repeat the lines that Jennifer had given to police, and each time it felt like a punch to her gut. They had to recite, "Shut up or I'll cut you. Your man's over in Germany." And it's been a long time. Jennifer was horrified, but she still didn't rush. She dismissed five of the seven men right away and had the other two men repeat the lines. Ronald Cotton actually got his wrong. He said, quote, "Shut up or I'll kill you." The actual words were, "Shut up or I'll cut you." But Ronald Cotton was the man in the photo she had already picked out. He seemingly matched the composite sketch. The detective had him repeat the line correctly, and this time, Jennifer identified him. She said, quote, "There was not one doubt in my mind." She didn't have to say it out loud. She wrote the number 5 on a piece of paper, Ronald's number, and handed it to the detective, who then handed it to Ronald's lawyer. If she had been at all unsure, she just watched this transaction. She now knew the man that came to this lineup, the man in the photo array, had brought a lawyer. Detective Galdon said, "We thought it might be the guy. It's the same person you picked from the photos." So this was the man, Jennifer thought. This was the man she would later say violated her body, devastated her soul, and shattered her spirit. She was sure, but she was wrong. I'm going to pause now for a word from our sponsors. We can all use a little help sometimes. Whether you are suffering from grief or trauma, or maybe you're in the clouds of depression, BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for you. From your phone, laptop, or tablet, you can connect with a professional counselor via text, chat, phone, or video, and start communicating with your counselor in under 24 hours. BetterHelp has over 3,000 licensed therapists in all 50 states, treating depression, stress, anxiety, trauma, grief, and other issues that so many of us suffer from. If you're not happy with your counselor, you can request a new one at any time with no additional charges, and everything you share is confidential. And there's even financial aid for those who qualify. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Southern Fried True Crime listeners get 10% off your first month with the discount code SOUTHERN. Why not get started today? Go to betterhelp.com/southern. Simply fill out a questionnaire to help them assess your needs and get matched with a counselor you'll love. That's betterhelp.com/southern. Sure, you're a fan of true crime, but are you really ready to put your skills to the test and be crowned an undisputed expert? Then try your hand at Parcast Network's new trivia podcast, Killer Knowledge. It's all the murder, mystery, and suspense you've come to expect from Parcast, now in a fast-paced, interactive format. Every Tuesday, two competitors go head-to-head to correctly answer multiple-choice true crime questions. Whoever gains the most points after 20 questions wins. Each episode dives deep into a different shocking topic from history, such as the Manson family, Jimmy Hoffa, and even the Jonestown Massacre. With each question and answer comes additional context surrounding the event, enlightening even the most knowledgeable true crime lover. You can play by yourself, challenge your friends, and prove your prowess by sharing your results with Parcast on social media. You never know. You may even find yourself in the hot seat one day. Follow Killer Knowledge Free on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Check out more Parcast shows on Spotify by searching for Parcast in the Spotify search bar or go to Spotify.com/Parcast. Jennifer tried to go on with her life, but she could not stay in Burlington. She stayed at her brother's house in Chapel Hill and commuted to her classes at Elon. Friends expected her to recover quickly. Were you cut? Did he hit you? So it was just sex? Again, in the 1980s, the trauma of sexual assault was not something that was mainstream. People thought it was unfortunate, but if you lived and were not outwardly scarred, you should be able to just get over it. Early on, her relationship with Paul began to crumble. Like so many people, he didn't understand. "Why didn't you fight back?" he asked. She tried to explain, "He was bigger than me. He had a knife." And then Paul told her he had to ask, but did you like it? In her book, Jennifer said she knew this was the end of their relationship, even though it went on for months. Paul stood by her through the trial. But at this moment, she knew everything was broken. Adding insult to injury, she opened her mail one day and got a bill from Memorial Hospital. $500 for the incomplete rape kit and exam. She was so angry. She showed the bill to her counselor, Sadie, who was also furious. "You never should have seen this," she told Jennifer. "The state pays for this." And she dealt with it. Within a month, on August 28th, Ronald Cotton had his first hearing in the case. It was a probable cause hearing. The assistant DA assured her there was nothing to worry about. They had an excellent case. But the second victim had not chosen Ronald Cotton at the lineup, so they were only trying him for Jennifer's case. But the second victim in the case was at the hearing. Her name was Mary. Her name was redacted in most court documents, and she never wanted to go public like Jennifer eventually did. "I won't use her real name." Unlike Jennifer, Mary had fought back. She had been slapped and bitten, and he had left many bruises and marks on her body. He had shone a flashlight directly in her eyes to be sure Mary couldn't see him. Jennifer wondered if he had done that after realizing that Jennifer could see him during her attack. Jennifer was called to the stand and told her story. She remembered thinking that not only were the ADA and the detectives counting on her, Mary was counting on her. Mary, who had been too traumatized to testify. She told her story and was quickly off the stand. Ronald Cotton was charged with first-degree rape, first-degree breaking and entering, and first-degree sexual offense. The judge increased his bond from $150,000 to $450,000. Ronald thought his family might have been able to raise the first amount. This new ruling definitively meant he would stay in jail until trial. As the trial drew near, Jennifer's brother Joe returned from Germany. Like the rest of the family, he didn't really know what to say, but he did tell her he needed his house back. Jennifer didn't seem exactly hurt by this, or at least not bitter in hindsight. She knew she would have to be in Burlington a lot for the trial, and she was still in school there. So she rented a new apartment, with her bedroom on the second floor. Still, she said at least once a week, she would wake up terrified, sure that she had heard something. She said the Burlington police always came quickly. Search her house, look under her bed, check outside. They never treated her like she was crazy. She presumed that Detective Galden had told them to take care of her. Ronald Cotton's trial was set to begin in early January. This time there would be no plea bargain. He had learned his lesson. He pled not guilty and was given a court-appointed attorney. He would remember August 1st, 1984, as the day his life changed forever. He had stayed out the night before with his girlfriend. When he got back to his mother's house that morning, the police had already been there with a search warrant. His mother told him he had better go down to the police station and straighten things out. His girlfriend believed in him and insisted on going with him. He borrowed his sister Patricia's car. His other sister, who went by the nickname Tootie, also came along. Patricia needed her car back by 3 p.m. to go to work, so Tootie came along to drive it back in case he wasn't finished by then. Ronald had been born in Burlington in December of 1961. He was the same age as Jennifer Thompson, just a few months older. He had several siblings, some with different fathers. Unlike his half-brother, Ron considered himself lucky that he had his father in his life. It didn't always work out that way. Most of his siblings didn't have contact with their fathers. His father would support him throughout his trials, prison time, and the rest of his life. He told Detective Galden that he had heard they were looking for him and was there to prove he didn't do it. He was searched, and they found a utility knife in his pocket. Not a weapon, really, but still a knife. He was read his rights and arrested, but he refused an attorney because he insisted he hadn't done the crime. He had an alibi when the detectives asked him where he was on the night of July 28th. He had been at a party, seen by several friends and one of his brothers. He got a ride home from a friend at around 2:30 or 3 in the morning. He diligently wrote down the names of the witnesses. What he didn't realize was that he had the date mixed up. When his mother visited him in jail, she told him he had been at home asleep on the couch that evening. She, her boyfriend, and his sisters all saw him. It was a crucial mistake, because now those witnesses he named would not be able to say they were with him on the 28th. His attorney tried to correct this at trial, but it didn't matter. The damage was done. In the book, Picking Cotton, Ron remembers the other detective, called Sully, told him, quote, "Saw your girlfriend earlier. You think you're Mr. Big Shot going around town screwing white women, don't you? Well, we got your ass." Ron would always believe that he was targeted because he dated white women, and it's a fair assumption. His trial began on January 7th. Jennifer Thompson walked confidently into the courtroom. Detective Galden warned her about the blame the victim technique that would most likely be used against her on the stand. They would ask about her past, if she drank, what she wore, etc. He said, "Don't let it unnerve you." She didn't. When she looked behind her, she saw Sadie, her sister Janet, and her boyfriend, and her parents. Then she looked on the other side and was amazed. It looked like Ronald Cotton's entire family showed up for him. She was hurt. Her own brothers hadn't shown up for her. But she persevered on the stand. The only time she broke down crying was when the ADA, Jim Robertson, asked her to describe the forced oral sex. She finally said, "Do I have to say it?" And the judge ordered a recess. When she came back, the prosecutor went straight to the identification. He asked her if she saw the man in the courtroom who had broken into her apartment that early morning on July 29th and who, quote, had sexual intercourse with her and oral sex with her. Even a prosecutor in 1984 wasn't using the real words of rape or sexual assault. But Jennifer said yes, firmly, and glared at Ronald Cotton. She refused to be scared. She wanted to meet his eyes. She was asked to point him out, and she did. She later remembered that Ronald Cotton remained expressionless. He would remember being terrified and not wanting to show any emotion. He didn't want to appear menacing or scared. And he did feel sorry for this young woman. He knew she had made a mistake. He wasn't as angry with her as he thought he would be. His attorney, Phil Mosley, did go for the classic "what were you wearing" technique. He kept calling her underwear panties, a more sexualized term. He asked her if she left her blinds open when she changed. He asked her why she didn't go to bed in a nightgown or something more appropriate than purple panties. Jennifer was angry now. She said, quote, "I don't know that it makes any difference what I would have worn that night. I think if I had had on blue jeans and a sweatshirt, that it would not have made any difference in the world. And if I walked outside of my bedroom stark naked, that doesn't give anybody the right to take what is not theirs." She was forceful, and she was right. Mosley simply said, "That's your answer?" "That's my answer," she snapped back. After the state rested, the defense put on a bunch of alibi witnesses. Each member of Ronald Cotton's family took the stand and swore he was at home that evening. Phil Mosley would later say that Ron's first alibi, when he got his nights confused, had done enough damage. Now it looked like his family was just lying to protect him, no matter how sincere they seemed in court. They were no match for the fortitude of Jennifer Thompson. During closing arguments, the defense really hit home hard that there was zero physical evidence in this case. No fingerprints, no blood. There was that piece of black foam, but that could have been from any shoe. They couldn't even find the shoe from Ron that would match it. In the end, that didn't matter. Jennifer Thompson's word was enough. After 4 hours, the jury convicted Ronald Cotton. During sentencing, the judge brought up Ron's previous conviction and called him a menace to society when he gave him a life sentence plus 50 years. He didn't want there to be any chance Ron could be paroled. Jennifer Thompson remembers this at the time as the happiest day of her life. She said she prayed when she went to bed that night that Cotton would die miserably in jail, but quote, "Before he left this earth for hell, I wanted that he know the horror of being raped." And then Ronald Cotton was sent to Central Prison in Raleigh. In the book, Picking Cotton, he describes a scene straight out of Shawshank Redemption, with other inmates shouting, "Fresh meat," and "Hey, pretty boy, I got something for you," as he walked down the corridor to his cell. Ron would always stay tough in prison. If someone even made a vague threat, he often went on the offensive first, scaring the person away. He was a survivor. He worked out religiously, keeping his body in great shape, and stayed away from drugs. He wanted his mind and body to be ready for anything. He asked for kitchen duty because he knew that kitchen workers were allowed to eat alone in the kitchen, away from the crowded cafeteria where fights often broke out. 3 months into his incarceration at Central, he saw a young man who looked familiar. He realized he looked like the composite sketch he had seen in the paper before the police arrested him. So he said, "Excuse me, where are you from?" The man answered, "Burlington." Ron said, "That right? Me too. I think I've seen you around." "Name's Cotton, Ron Cotton," he said, introducing himself. The man answered simply, "Bobby Poole." Then Ron said, quote, "Fact is, you look like the drawing of the suspect in the crime I'm locked up for. Did you have anything to do with it?" Bobby Poole said, "Nah, man, not me," and walked away. Ron asked around and found out that Bobby Leon Poole was also at Central Prison for a rape conviction. Over the next couple of years, Ron fought when he had to, but tried his best to stay out of trouble. He had a knack for eventually making friends with people who originally tried to mess with him. Bobby Poole also got a job in the kitchen, and to Ron's irritation, people often got them confused. He felt it was proof. Even the guards couldn't tell them apart sometimes. One day, a guy named Kenny, who had been in for a while, it was something of a jailhouse lawyer himself, called Ron over. He had studied law while in prison, filing his own appeals, and helping other inmates. He had been helping Bobby Poole with his case, and Poole had admitted to him that he raped the women Ron Cotton was serving time for. Poole apparently wasn't aware that only the Jennifer Thompson case was tried. Kenny was someone Ron had already fought and made peace with, so he was suspicious of his motives now. But still, it bothered him. He got out a legal pad and started making notes. Bobby Poole and he looked a lot alike, except Poole was 6 feet tall and Ron was 6'4". He and the courts had always assumed that Jennifer had guessed his height wrong. She had said 6 foot. Mary had said 5'9" or 5'10", closer to 6 feet, as opposed to Ron's towering 6'4" frame. He wrote about how inmates and guards both mixed the men up all the time. He wrote how Bobby Poole was living in Burlington and was convicted of rape with breaking and entering right around the time that Jennifer and Mary were attacked. Once, one of his sisters came to visit. Bobby Poole asked her name and if he could write to her. Ron played along, giving him a fake name for his sister. But he said he wouldn't give Bobby her address until he asked her himself if it was okay. And he asked Bobby to take a picture with him so he could send it to her. "Sure," Bobby answered. And then a member of the JC Club who had a Polaroid camera came by and for $2, Ron posed in a photograph with Bobby Poole. He had no intention of sending it to his sister. He sent the photo with a letter with all of his notes to his attorney, Phil Mosley. But months went by and nothing happened. Ron started to get angry. If he was going to be in prison for a crime he didn't commit, he would kill the man that put him there. He started making a shiv for Bobby Poole. As I said before, Ron's father had always supported him, and he visited him a lot. When Ron told his father of his plans, his father was blunt. "If you take this man's life, you ain't never coming home. You'll belong in here." Ron wound up dropping the shiv down one of the kitchen drains. His father was right. Even if he spent his life in prison for a crime he didn't commit, he didn't want to become a murderer. He believed in God. He believed in heaven and hell. And he believed there would be a greater justice waiting for him someday. Right after Ron made his decision and threw away the weapon he had made, Bobby Poole was transferred to another prison. Not long after that, Ron was coming back from the gym, walking down the corridor, and heard some men singing, harmonizing. It was the song, "Will the Circle Be Unbroken?" He thought those men sounded joyful, and when they invited him to join their small choir, he accepted. It was a new beginning for him, letting go of the hate and murderous feelings towards Bobby Poole and focusing on something that made him happy. At the start of his second year incarcerated, Ron finally got a letter from Phil Mosley, who had indeed been working hard on his behalf. The North Carolina Supreme Court had overturned his verdict, ordering a new trial. During his first trial, Mosley had tried to get into the record that the second woman raped had not chosen his photo from the array, nor has she identified him in the lineup. The prosecution had always argued that she was too hysterical. She had sobbed through both of the ordeals. He honestly didn't believe that she could identify her attacker. Remember, unlike Jennifer, she was held down with a flashlight shining in her eyes. But the fact that she did not identify Ronald Cotton was exculpatory evidence, meaning it was evidence that tended to show Ron's innocence. If he had raped both women, she should have recognized him too. It's one of the reasons the DA didn't charge him with both rapes. Mary couldn't identify him at the time. Well, by the time of his second trial in November of 1987, Mary decided that she did in fact recognize him and claimed that she had all along and was just afraid. She too had been put in the room with those seven men, with no mirror or glass separating them, and was terrified. I believe this was an egregious error in this case. They didn't know about the phenomena of unconscious transference yet, or cross-racial bias and identification in the 1980s. These are much more modern concepts. But those women were traumatized victims and should never have been put in the same room with men who could be their rapists or even remind them of their rapist. For Jennifer, it only hardened her resolve. For Mary, she was terrified the man would get away with it and come after her for identifying him. But 3 years later, Mary had changed her mind. So the DA added a second charge of rape, as well as breaking and entering. Ronald Cotton was going to trial for Jennifer and Mary's attacks now. Two white women were going to identify him on the stand. Ron did not feel very hopeful. There was a new assistant DA, a young black man, and for some reason this made Ron nervous. He felt that a black ADA would have something to prove. He wasn't wrong. Again, Jennifer was the face of composure and calmness as she recounted her story and positively identified Ron Cotton again. She was so angry when she got the call that Ronald Cotton had gotten a new trial. She had started her life over. She was no longer with Paul. She had graduated, made a new friend circle, and had gotten married. But before her marriage, the dating scene had been really hard, and she had been drinking some, and by her account, doing some cocaine. It numbed her. She didn't feel the pain when she was doing it, but she said she always felt disgusted with herself the next day. A friend talked her into going with her on a trip to Florida for her spring break. Jennifer reluctantly agreed. She was a walking bruise. In the Florida heat, she wore jeans and sweatshirts, terrified to wear anything too revealing. But she still met a man named Vincent Canino from New York, nicknamed Vinny. He bought her a drink on her last night there and insisted on taking Jennifer and her friend to lunch the next day. He really was a gentleman. So Jennifer gave him her phone number and address so that they could stay in touch. They talked for 3 hours a day on the phone, and he wrote her a letter a day. Jennifer flew out to visit him to specifically talk to him about her rape. She didn't want to spring it on him later and have him run. But Vinny wasn't going anywhere. She decided to move to Long Island with Vinny after her graduation. Before she left, she had an emotional exchange with Paul. He admitted to her that before her rape, he had submitted their names in the lottery for married housing. He was so sorry he had let her down. She apologized too, and they hugged and left each other on good terms. She never blames Paul for his reaction to her rape. She understood then and when she wrote her book why he reacted that way. So she felt good about getting that closure with Paul and was looking forward to her life with Vinny. But she wasn't happy in Long Island, and she told Vinny the truth. He told her he would go wherever she was. So in the spring of 1986, they moved back to Winston-Salem, and Vinny proposed. So Jennifer was happily married and starting a new life when her life was turned upside down again with Ronald Cotton's second trial. She was so angry. She had found real happiness, and she was determined that Ronald Cotton would stay in prison. Not only was she a great witness again, at his second trial, Mary herself testified this time and was much stronger. She described her attack and also positively identified Ronald Cotton. But that wasn't Ron's only problem. By now, they had matched Bobby Poole's blood type to a smear found on Mary's door. They had two witnesses that said Bobby Poole had confessed to them, Kenny from where Ron was incarcerated, and a man named Dennis, held at the Alamance Jail. And they had details from the rapes that Bobby Poole was convicted of, and there were many similarities to the attacks on Jennifer and Mary. But it didn't matter. The judge refused to allow Bobby Poole to be called to testify, so none of that evidence would be heard by the jury. Although Ron later wrote that it did give him some pleasure knowing that there was a record. The court reporter had typed all of that up for the record, even if the jury couldn't hear it. And maybe there would be a next time. And Ron had a new witness to face, a manager from Summer Seafood, where he had worked during the attacks, the one who had called in the tip. He now came forward to say that Ron often harassed the waitresses where he worked, slapping their bottoms or pinching them, making lewd remarks, etc. It wasn't true, but it was his word against Ron's, for now. And finally, a huge problem with this trial. 4 Black people were pulled in for the jury pool, and the judge himself dismissed one of them. The young Black prosecutor used his peremptory challenges to get rid of the other 3. Ron's defense made a motion for mistrial based on the exclusion of Black people from the jury. The new Black assistant DA, Luke Turner, got up and made the argument that all 3 of the people he excluded were somehow connected to Ronald Cotton or his family. We are talking friends of a friend, a former neighbor of Ron's mother, extremely loose connections at best. But the judge sided with the prosecution. So an all-white jury sat to watch 2 white women positively identify Ronald Cotton as their rapist, while not being allowed to hear any evidence about Bobby Poole, another viable suspect. Ron knew he was going back to prison. He was not shocked at the verdict, only sad. At sentencing, when he spoke for himself, he said he didn't blame Jennifer or Mary, that he sympathized with them. He asked that his sentences be served concurrently and then sang a song he wrote, "Until God Came in My Life." He saw angry faces when he was done. He later wrote, quote, "I guess because I didn't show remorse. How can you be sorry for something you didn't do?" In the end, Ronald Cotton would serve almost 11 years in prison. Many different prisons. He was transferred often. Not for anything he did, but usually because of prison overcrowding. He got a letter back when he wrote Phil Mosley after one move. Phil wrote reluctantly, telling him that he had done all he could do for him. He was now in the hands of the North Carolina Appellate Defender's Office. "We'll help them the best we can," Phil promised. Ron was getting used to all the moving. It hurt that he lost the choir he loved to sing in, but he never tried to start another. He went on about his business of surviving his life on the inside. Bobby Poole was transferred into one of Ron's other prisons as well. He ignored him. It wasn't worth it. He later learned that his first appellate attorney had not raised the reversible error the judge made by keeping the Bobby Poole evidence out. Ron was despondent. Another attorney, Malcolm Hunter, from the office delivered the news and told him he would be taking over his case. Hunter received a letter from Ron telling him he was heartbroken and wished he was dead. He immediately wrote back and said, "Don't lose heart, Mr. Cotton. We have not finished your case by a long shot." And he meant it. In September of 1992, Hunter wrote to Ron and told him an attorney and law professor named Richard Rosen had agreed to look into his case. He met Mr. Rosen that fall, who insisted he call him Rich. He was bringing in another attorney named Tom Lambeth, who is from Burlington, so he could better assist with all the local players. He also assured Ron that he knew his family could not afford to pay, so he was doing the work pro bono. He really believed in Ron Cotton. Rich was disturbed that Ron was convicted purely on eyewitness testimony. He later told a news reporter, quote, "In so many cases, eyewitnesses can be unreliable. At that point, I had no idea how strong and compelling Jennifer Thompson was. I'm not sure any jury in the world would have acquitted him in the face of her testimony." But he still wasn't giving up on Ron. I'm going to pause now for a final word from our sponsors. When you are selling online, getting orders out can be a pain. It's confusing to pick a carrier. Who has the best rates? How can you track your orders? That's why you need ShipStation. It's the fastest, easiest, and most affordable way to manage and ship your orders. In just a few clicks, you'll manage your orders, print labels, and get your product out the door fast, making your customers very happy. ShipStation makes it so easy. No matter where you're selling, Amazon, Etsy, or from your own website like I do, ShipStation brings all your orders into one simple interface. You can manage your shipments from any device, even your cell phone. ShipStation works with all major carriers, including USPS, FedEx, UPS, and even Amazon Fulfillment, so you can easily compare and choose the best shipping solution for you and your customer. ShipStation also offers big discounts on shipping costs not usually available to small businesses. You can access the same postage discounts that are usually reserved for Fortune 500 companies. No wonder ShipStation is the number one choice for online retailers. You'll ship more in less time at the best rates available. And act now, Southern Fried True Crime listeners. Try ShipStation for free for 60 days when you use the offer code Southern Fried. There's absolutely no risk. You can start your free trial without even entering your credit card information. Just visit ShipStation.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Southern Fried. That's ShipStation.com, then enter the offer code Southern Fried. ShipStation.com. Make ship happen. In the summer of 1984, Ron Cotton watched, along with the rest of the world, as O.J. Simpson made a run for it in his white Bronco. And also like the rest of the world, he followed the case intently and was especially curious to learn more about this new DNA science. DNA had not been around during the time of Ron's first two trials, but even the blood type evidence of Bobby Poole hadn't been allowed into trial anyway. Still, he thought it was worth a shot, and so did Rosen and Lambeth. When Ron called Rich Rosen about his DNA testing, Rich told him that he was coming to see him in person to speak with him about making the motion. He and Tom Lambeth explained that though they believed Ron, like every attorney, they would always have some small bit of doubt. They had to tell him the risks of DNA testing. If Ron had lied, this could prove definitively that he had raped Jennifer and Mary. Ron was not insulted by their bluntness and answered firmly, quote, "I promise you, I didn't do this. My DNA is not going to be there." Not long after, Ron was moved to a Tennessee prison. He personally begged the warden not to allow the move. There was no way his family could make an 11-hour drive to visit him, and more importantly, neither could his attorneys. The warden said no, but did promise to arrange for daily phone privileges in Tennessee. Rich mailed him a copy of the motion for appropriate relief that they had filed with Alamance County. It was an affidavit to allow for DNA testing. It was a huge document, signed not only by his original trial attorneys, but also several waitresses from Summer Seafood, who had not been called in Ron's second trial. They insisted Ron had never behaved inappropriately with them. It also included a chart of Bobby Poole's crimes and their similarities to the attacks on Jennifer and Mary. The motion was granted. Ron was elated until he got a call from Rich. "You aren't a match, Ron," he said. Ron wrote later he at first thought this was good news, but in reality, it wasn't. The test didn't exclude him either. The problem was the samples were so old. They actually needed a new blood sample from Jennifer to separate the different DNA samples found at the scene. So far, they had identified Paul's DNA and possibly Jennifer's, but it was too disintegrated. Jennifer Thompson Canino, now married and a mother to 4-year-old triplets, got a phone call she never expected. Detective Galden often checked in on her over the years, but he said he needed to talk in person. He asked her if she'd ever heard of DNA. She said, "You mean like the O.J. Simpson stuff?" The former detective, now a captain, and one of the other original assistant DAs, Rob Johnson, had to come see her and explain that Ronald Cotton had won a motion for DNA testing. But her blood sample had degraded too much since 1984, and they needed a new sample. She was so upset of the thought of having to give her blood, of having to go back to this case yet again, of reliving her trauma. She asked them if she could refuse. Yes. But they would wind up in court, and she would eventually be ordered to give the sample anyway. She agreed to give the sample if they set it up for that day. She was at a nearby hospital giving blood within a couple of hours. Jennifer was still angry, but thought maybe now she'll never have to hear about it again. In June of 1995, as OJ was on trial, the warden called Ron in. He said he had good news and bad. Ron asked for the bad news first. "You're going back to court," he said. "The good news is the guy that committed the crime you're doing time for confessed. You're going home tomorrow." The North Carolina officers who drove Ron Cotton back to Burlington talked to him a lot on the ride. They stopped for McDonald's and apologized for keeping Ron cuffed. It was protocol. He didn't mind. He was enjoying his first taste of McDonald's French fries in 11 years. They told Ron that even after Bobby Poole's DNA linked him to the crime, it still took him 5 hours to confess. When he got to the Alamance County Jail, he was formally passed from the Department of Corrections to the County of Alamance. The transport officers said goodbye, and another bailiff brought him a bag of clothes from his family. It was a purple shirt and black jeans. Ron Cotton wrote in his book that the shirt still hung in his closet to that day. He got to see and hug his family before he was brought before a judge for a short but formal hearing dismissing all charges. Assistant DA Rob Johnson, one of the original prosecutors, shook Ron's hand and apologized on behalf of the state of North Carolina. Ron found out later that Rob Johnson had worked with a judge to make a special exception so that Ron could walk out the back door to freedom instead of being sent back down for what they call deprocessing. Ron hugged all of his attorneys, Rich, Tom, and even his old attorney Phil, who had shown up for him. And then he walked out into the sunshine, a free man. And now Mike Galden and ADA Rob Johnson had to go tell Jennifer. The DNA in Mary's rape kit matched Bobby Leon Poole, even though it wasn't found in Jennifer's rape kit, but neither was Ron Cotton's. There's really no way to put this delicately, but because Jennifer had smartly distracted her rapist and escaped, he had not ejaculated inside of her. That's why Bobby's DNA profile was not found. But not only did the crimes match, once confronted with the DNA in Mary's case, Bobby Poole confessed to both of the sexual assaults. Jennifer was floored. She still wasn't sure she believed it. Mike and Rob explained he knew too many details about her house and the attack. He was the guy. In the book, Picking Cotton, Jennifer describes this moment as an ocean of confusion crashing down on her, muffling their voices. She heard them say, "This is not your fault. We all made this mistake." All she could think of was that in the second trial, they had brought Bobby Poole into the courtroom and she hadn't recognized him. How could she not recognize the real man who had violated her? She was numb and thanked the men as they left, but her world was turned upside down. She began sinking. She was in despair over the guilt she felt for robbing Ron Cotton of 11 years of his life. She was even afraid he or his family might want revenge. She was a swirling mess of emotions: guilt, fear, shame, confusion, anger, and sadness. She was also enrolling her triplets in kindergarten and was enough worried about retribution from Ron or his family that she had to tell the principal of the school for extra precautions. She had to tell many people in her life that hadn't known about this before. She met Mike Galden for coffee while her triplets were given the grand tour of the jail, with mugshots, fingerprints, and fake police IDs. They were delighted. Jennifer and Mike talked for a long time. He was also haunted, as she wrote, for getting it wrong. He was a good cop. He had never wanted to convict the wrong guy. He told her he had spent hours poring over the case file to see where he went wrong. He wanted to make sure it never happened again. And, he assured her, he had seen and spoken with Ron Cotton. Ron had no ill feelings towards Jennifer. He was happy and wanted to move on with his life. She was comforted by this, and her fear melted. Now all that was left was the guilt and the shame. She berated herself. How could she have been so stupid? Months passed, and in the meantime, Ron went on the Larry King Live show. He expressed how hard it was to find a job. Also on the show, his attorney Tom Lambeth was interviewed and announced that the governor of North Carolina was going to sign a pardon of innocence. His record would finally be cleared. Prosecutor Rob Johnson was also on the TV show and explained that in a way, Jennifer, Mary, and Ron had all been victims of the same rapist. Afterwards, Tom Lambeth promised to help Ron find a job, and he kept his word. Ron started working at LabCorp, ironically, the lab that had tested his DNA. Ron worked in shipping and receiving. He met a woman named Robin who worked there also. They started talking, then having lunch, and soon were dating. Ron was in love, and Robin felt fiercely protective of him. She found out his father had put in a nursing home, and Ron hadn't been able to figure out which one. Robin found the home and took Ron to see his father, who cried tears of happiness. Also at this time, the state of North Carolina capped damages for wrongful convictions at $5,000, regardless of how much time was spent in prison. So now, Tom Lambeth and Rich Rosen had a new project. They wanted to find a legislator to support a new bill that would provide the appropriate amount of reparations to a wrongfully convicted person. For now, Ron took his $5,000 and took classes to get his GED. He eventually quit school because he needed a second job. He and Robin wanted to get married, buy a house, and start a family. He needed the money. Ron and Robin married in December of 1996 on Ron's 36th birthday. Also in 1996, Jennifer was approached by a producer for Frontline on PBS. They were doing a story about how eyewitnesses can make mistakes. Jennifer wasn't sure she wanted to do it. Rape Shield laws had kept her name out of the press. She would lose her privacy. And Ron Cotton would be participating. She still couldn't face him. She agreed to do the show, but they taped their segments separately. The program was called What Jennifer Saw, and it aired in February of 1997. Jennifer had still not faced Ron Cotton. But as she watched him on the show, she felt awful. He wondered to the interviewer why he had never heard from her. Ron said, quote, "I would like to hear what she has to say, in her own words, to me." It haunted her. She wrote in their book, Picking Cotton, that she looked around her home at photos of her husband and children and the life she had built and realized that Ron Cotton was her age. He had been robbed of marrying and starting a family. She called Mike Galden that day. The detective, who is now captain of the department, knew what she wanted as soon as she asked for a favor. He said, "You want to meet Ron, don't you?" She said, "Yes, and can you help?" He said, "Absolutely. Let me make a few calls." Ron was delighted to get the call. He accepted immediately. To his surprise, Robin was angry. She felt too protective of him. "What could she possibly want from you now?" she asked. He argued with Robin for a week before he wore her down, on the condition that she could be there, that she could face Jennifer too. They all met on April 4th, 1997, at the First Baptist Church of Elon College. Vinny and Jennifer and Ron and Robin, along with Tom Lambeth, Mike Galden, and a few others involved. Jennifer and Vinny got there first and were waiting with ADA Rob Johnson. They were all introduced, and then Jennifer asked if she could speak with Ron and Robin privately. Ron later wrote that she looked very nervous. She said to him, quote, "Mr. Cotton, if I spent the rest of my life telling you how sorry I am, it wouldn't come close to how I feel. Can you ever forgive me?" Ron immediately said, "I forgive you. I'm not angry at you. All I want is for us all to go on and have a happy life." He wrote in the book Picking Cotton that for the first time, He looked into Jennifer's eyes and didn't see the hate he had always seen there before. And the next thing he knew, they were all hugging and crying. He said, quote, even Robin, Mrs. Ballbreaker herself, was bawling. Jennifer was soon told about the work towards a new bill for reparations and personally wrote a letter in support, along with all of Ron's attorneys, the original prosecutors, and Mike Galden, the original detective. Eventually, the bill was passed, and Ron received close to $110,000. The state actually fought having to pay for the time he spent in county jail awaiting trial. Then they tried to make him repay his court-appointed attorney's fees. His attorneys went to battle for him every time, and every time he won. In August of 2008, Governor Mike Easley signed another change to the compensation statute. Those that receive a pardon of innocence are granted $50,000 for each year incarcerated, with a cap of $750,000. But it was only for those who had been pardoned after January 1st, 2004. Ron had been pardoned in 1995. He was not eligible. But he had taken his original compensation that he had fought so hard to get and bought a tract of land and built a house. He and Robin had a baby girl named Raven. And he and Jennifer settled into a comfortable friendship. Jennifer had become an activist, traveling all over the country, speaking about the problems of eyewitness testimony, telling her own story over and over again. She often went and spoke for those condemned to die if their conviction was based only on eyewitness testimony. Ron traveled with her whenever he could. He worked a lot, and his family was younger, so it wasn't as often as he liked, but Ron and Jennifer became very close friends. Jennifer had learned a great deal over the years and spoke of the need for double-blind testing when it came to eyewitnesses. Instead of a lineup, the officer would show the victim one photo at a time or one suspect at a time in person. And the investigating officer cannot be in the room, so there is no chance of verbal or nonverbal clues about who to pick. Because Ron was in the photo array and the physical lineup, Jennifer had felt sure. Her real attacker wasn't there, so her mind went to the next closest looking man. And over time, her mind tricked her into being absolutely sure it had been Ron Cotton. What if Bobby Poole had been in that lineup? She might have chosen the right man. Ron Cotton has always maintained that he was targeted because he dated white women. In fact, the tip called in was from his boss at Summer Seafood, who obviously had a vendetta, because he went to the second trial and outright lied about Ron harassing waitresses. Ron also remembers that Detective Sully, who made a remark about him being Mr. Big Shot for screwing white women. Mike Galden was just doing his job. He didn't know about Bobby Poole yet, but someone did. Someone could have spoken up later. But by then, Jennifer had been so sure. She had chosen Ron twice in the lineups, and then she chose him twice at trial. And evidence of Bobby Poole was suppressed at his second trial. Sure, many people involved in this case made innocent mistakes, but that evidence should have been allowed into testimony. Captain Mike Galden went on to implement new procedures in the Burlington Police Department, making sequential lineups and double-blind procedures policy. His was the first department in the state to do so. Jennifer Thompson Canino founded and is president of the Healing Justice Project. It is about confronting the personal toll of wrongful convictions for all involved. She is still an active speaker. You can find many videos online, including a TED Talk she did a few years ago. A major source for this episode was obviously the book, Picking Cotton, A Memoir of Injustice and Redemption. And while it goes in depth into the fallibility of eyewitness testimony, specifically the unconscious transference theory, it doesn't speak on the problems of cross-racial identification. I've discussed this before in my episode on the wrongful conviction of Willie Grimes. Many studies have shown that eyewitnesses are better able to recognize people in their own racial or ethnic group. In State versus Henderson, the state of New Jersey called this, quote, own race bias. Two prominent researchers in the field of eyewitness testimony, named June Chance and Alvin Goldstein, contend that judges are hesitant to allow testimony about cross-racial identification. Judges reason that it's because it has become a joke. For years, stand-up comedians of every race have said, "They all look alike to me." Judges believe that because of this long-running joke, jurors are already aware of their own race bias. If they want to discuss it in deliberations, that's fine, but it doesn't need to be in testimony. But Chance and Goldstein argue that many jurors would be hesitant to bring it up because they don't want to be seen as having racist views, and that it should be allowed in open court so that jurors feel comfortable debating it. I completely agree. If there is any chance a witness is mistaken, this should be discussed. Studies going back to the 1960s prove own race bias. In Ron Cotton's case, they were all black men. Maybe Jennifer would still have made the wrong choice, even with Bobby Poole in the lineup. The two men did look remarkably similar. But Jennifer herself is sure that because she never saw Bobby Poole first, Ron's face became the face of her rapist. As for Bobby Poole, he died of cancer while still in prison. Jennifer reached out to him by letter, asking to meet him. He never responded. She had learned about the power of forgiveness from her friend Ron, and she wanted to let go of the hate she felt for Bobby Poole. He denied her that chance, but she has chosen forgiveness anyway. She felt that Ron forgave her for taking 11 years of his life when she didn't think she deserved his forgiveness. But he taught her why. Here is a quote from Jennifer. "Forgiveness is tricky. People think when you forgive someone, you excuse what they did. That's not what it is. It's about power and letting go." Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. Thank you to listener Suzanne Leet for suggesting this case. According to the Innocence Project, 367 people have now been exonerated by DNA testing. I highly recommend the book Picking Cotton, A Memoir of Injustice and Redemption. Written by Jennifer and Ron with Aaron Tornillo, this story of forgiveness, friendship, and activism is beautifully written, and I found myself in tears a lot towards the end. Go to their website, pickingcottonbook.com, to see photos of Ron and Bobby Poole, along with a composite sketch and many original documents. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify. I have recently joined Stitcher Premium, and for 1 month, you can try it out for free by using my promo code, Southern Fried. After that, for about $5 a month, you can listen to Southern Fried and many other shows ad-free. Go to StitcherPremium.com and use promo code Southern Fried to sign up for one free month. If you're interested in supporting the show, please visit my website, SouthernFriedTrueCrime.com. There you can sign up to be a patron of the show, make a one-time donation, or purchase show merchandise. That's SouthernFriedTrueCrime.com. And don't forget to check out my YouTube channel. If you have any case suggestions, please email SouthernFriedTrueCrime@gmail.com. Private messages on social media get lost, so email is best. And please feel free to reach out. I love hearing from you guys. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.